Hello, it's Jill Burridge here. Today I'm joined by Pam Firth. And Pam, you've got quite a few roles in your life. At the moment, you're an independent consultant in psychosocial palliative care. But as we'll discover, you've had quite a lot of roles. Let's start with palliative care itself, because what do you actually mean by the term palliative care?
Things have changed a bit, Jill, because palliative care, it was a term that was used to address the issues of people who had advanced cancer. Perhaps, or advanced things like motor neurone disease or multiple sclerosis. And it really meant that there was no active treatment and that treatment was addressed to cope with symptoms that were accompanying the diagnosis. But more recently, palliative care is being used very early on in terms of people's disease progression. And the aim is to help people with some of the side effects. So there's been a change from looking at palliative care and end-of-life care altogether, and now they tend to be more separate because with advanced treatments that people can live with cancer in particular for a long time.
What attracted you to getting involved in that particular area?
I suppose really I've always been interested in looking at the effects of loss and transitions, and I remember years ago when I worked in St Albans in what was then the Child and Family Psychiatric Clinic. I remember working with a young family where the dad had died and the little girl had been along to various physical examinations because she had a lot of tummy pains. And she was eventually referred to us at the clinic. And what we realised was that this little girl hadn't got any opportunity to grieve. And that linked with my own history because my grandfather was killed in the First World War. And so I'd been fathered by a father who had lost his father when he was 9. It had always been there in my history, this aspect of grief and children in particular. So when I worked in Oxford at the time and wanted a job nearer home, and I knew that there was the work going on in St Albans to develop the hospice care. So that's really what attracted me to it.
Do you feel that through your father, you experienced loss at a very early age, or the implications?
Yes.
Alerted something in you?
And I think when you talk to people in palliative care and in hospice work in particular, many people have come into that work because of having had family experiences. My father was quite unusual, I think, because he talked about his father a lot. So I knew what had happened when the telegraph man came to tell his mum that his father had died. He remembered that and he talked about that. And I suppose I realised that actually talking about things didn't make it any worse, it made it better.
Let's go back to how you first started. So when you left school, what did you do then?
Again, it shows how much your family shapes you because my great-grandmother had been involved with the suffragist movements and had run a soup kitchen in London. I remember stories about her doing that. And so I think I had a strong sense of social justice when I was growing up. And I decided that I'd really like to be a social worker. I was interested particularly in hospital social work. But in those days, you couldn't train until you were over 21. Which was quite right, really, when you think about it. Mm. So I left school and worked in a laboratory for 2 or 3 years. And then I eventually went to college in Portsmouth. It was interesting. The course in Portsmouth, in those days, you did 3 placements. And my first placement was in the probation office in Portsmouth, which was extremely amusing at one level because a lot of the court cases concerned rather drunken sailors. And I think I was very naive, so it was an interesting and challenging placement. And then I worked in the children's department and then latterly in child and family psychiatry. So when I left college, I worked in general social work, but I knew that I wanted to work in child and family psychiatry. So I changed over and came to work in St Albans.
And what did you take on in St Albans when you arrived?
I suppose another thing I've learnt is that in some professions you can be appointed above your skill level. And when I finished my training and I went to work in general social work, I was quite quickly given a job as a manager. But I really knew that actually I wasn't a manager, and that it was above what I could manage, really, as a quite young and fairly new social worker. So I applied for a job in St Albans, working in the Child and Family Psychiatric Clinic and working at a basic level as a social worker. It was the best thing I ever did. It was a marvellous experience, real learning.
But then you went on to take responsibility in quite significant ways. So you were a manager, really.
Well, eventually. But, you know, I knew I'd got a lot of living and learning to do before I could lead people, if you like, because I really like to think that actually it's about being a leader, really. At the time, I was working in St Albans Hospice, and then I moved to set up the family service at Isabel Hospice. And then eventually became deputy director there.
Which is in Welwyn Garden City.
Yes.
And at that stage, was the hospice movement quite new?
Yes. I mean, it was a really exciting time when I came to St Albans, because originally they were fundraising in St Albans and district to build a hospice. But at that time, we were a Macmillan team based in the old Waverley Lodge Hospital. So we were there for probably about 18 months before the day hospice was opened.
And that's Grove House in St Albans.
Yes. And that was such an exciting time. I really believed in this idea that we had to be accessible to the community. And what I really liked about St Albans Hospice was that they set up an information service as a very key part of the building. That was hugely successful. We had a young woman who was actually a radiotherapist but had a background in public health. So we set up this huge library of information. People came from all over the district, not always for themselves, but other people. You know, they might have a mother who lived in Edinburgh and they were worried about her, so they'd come to the service to perhaps get a bit more information. It was a terrific service, it really was.
So in that role in St Albans and then in Welwyn Garden City at the Isabel Hospice, what were the key skills that somebody like you really needed if you were going to deliver meaningful, successful palliative care?
You mentioned earlier on about Dame Cicely Saunders. She was kind of pretty unique, actually, because she trained as a hospital social worker. Then she trained as a nurse and then as a doctor. So she realised that the important thing when working with seriously ill people was holistic care, that you couldn't separate out the patient from the family and from the community. The idea of just specialising in having doctors and nurses available only really worked when they had somebody who could also think wider and think about the family and the schools and the workplace. And so I think that's what I brought into the team. So many times I would sit in a meeting and say, you know, what did this man do? You know, what's his story? What's his family like? Has he got grandchildren? It's not like my colleagues forgot that, but that was the aspect of the work that I could address, to think what that illness meant for the rest of the family.
And a lot of it must be coming to terms with something that is very distressing, very challenging, and emotionally is a complete upheaval.
And one of the things that, particularly for young families, I always think is an absolute financial disaster. And people are very frightened and very worried. And I think also what social work brings in to the equation is knowledge about benefits, access to practical support. So although, you know, I'm talking about giving emotional support to children and the family and grandchildren, the important thing is also the reality of their lives. who's going to pay the rent, how they're going to sort out the cost of driving to Mount Vernon or...
How many years did you work at the hospice in Welwyn Garden City then?
I worked there for 9 years, but I always worked part-time. And so I worked one day a week at Middlesex University teaching social work students.
And moved on then to take that up as a further career?
I had a very close colleague who I worked with a lot in palliative care, and he was given a year sabbatical, but he needed cover for the main lectures that he did in palliative care at Middlesex University. So he asked me to do his cover, and I just stayed on.
You've now developed an international role as a lecturer in palliative care. How did that come about?
I'd always, every other year, gone to the big world conferences, as we called them. In fact, they were European conferences. And they'd always had an elected board of directors. They were running some elections and they wanted a social worker to stand for one of the posts. And I did, and I got the post. So for 8 years, I was also a director of the European Association of Palliative Care, which meant that I had to go and give various lectures, mainly in Europe. And I was very lucky because I was asked to go and lecture quite a bit in Romania because I was very interested in the development of palliative care in Eastern Europe. One of the big aims of the European Association of Palliative Care is to make palliative medicine, particularly pain control, more available across the world, really. But in both Romania and Serbia, the reason the way the development has gone there is really due to a charity which is based in Orford in Kent called the Hospices of Hope, and that was started probably 20, 30 years ago. And the first hospice that they developed was in Brasov in Romania, which is up in the Carpathians. They then developed another one in Belgrade. And then later on, they were invited to develop palliative care in Serbia.
Because the UK was at the forefront, really, of the hospice movement, are we still seen as having one of the best networks of hospices in the
world? Absolutely. I would say our services are still second to none. We rate the highest across Europe and in the world. And I think that, you know, the development of particularly in palliative medicine, you know, the use of drugs, the development of drug, the dosage and so forth, and also different ways of offering care in this country has been really imaginative.
In St Albans, Grove House is daycare.
Yeah.
But they have a team of nurses, don't they, who are then on hand when the end draws nigh, whereas in Welwyn Garden City and also in Berkhamsted, it's residential, so you have beds. So how do you sort of determine what the right balance is?
In 2000, it was under the Tony Blair's government, he set up a government body to look at the whole issue of end-of-life care, and they produced an report which said that most people, if they were asked, actually wanted to die at home. And this was an enormously important movement, really. So out of that developed ideas of how we could keep people at home. What did people need in order to manage to die at home if that's what they wished? So you're talking about Grove House, which has what they call a hospice at home. Sometimes they call different names, but you're talking about hospice at home. And most hospices now have a hospice at home service designed to support families. It can be really, really difficult. And I have huge, huge respect for families trying to manage at home because it can be fraught with difficulty. Whatever we say, the services at the weekend are not always there. In some areas, the issue of getting drugs in the middle of the night is difficult. So it can be really, really challenging. So with the best will in the world, families will often say, well, I want to support my relative to die in his own bed. But when it actually comes to it, they can't manage. And I don't think people ought to be judged for that.
Part of the job, in a way, is making people understand that they don't need to feel guilty if what they set out to do isn't achievable in the
end. Absolutely.
So you are heading off to a conference again where you'll
Berlin.
Be speaking. Yes. So what will you be lecturing on this time?
It will be very, very interesting because we have two projects that we're actually lecturing on. And one I'm doing with my friend Steve Marshall, who used to be one of my students at Middlesex. And he's in the middle of some research supported by Marie Curie, looking at the needs of children and young people where a family member is seriously ill. So he and I are doing some work about that. But our main project is to talk about the needs of gay and trans folk and their needs in palliative care, because it can be really, really difficult. So we're raising issues about LGBT and particularly issues around families.
Very stimulating work you do. I don't know when you find time for all this, Pam, but anyway, you are also working in the counselling charity in St Albans, which covers Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire. So what's your role there?
When I worked in child and family psychiatry, I also did some extra training at the Tavistock. One of the things that I did was around group work. So in all the work that I've done, even in palliative care, I've always kept in touch with work at the Counselling Foundation. And I did a very, very minimal role every year running a group for students. And then when I retired from Isabel Hospice, there was a crisis. The tutor for the foundation certificate courses, the programme tutor, left. And so they asked me if I'd take it on. So I work 18 hours for the Counselling Foundation.
And this is not just palliative care or bereavement counselling. It is the whole gambit. Yes.
I love working for the charity. I think it is impressive, the work it does. It offers low-cost, very, very good counselling.
Who to?
In the area.
Everybody?
Everybody.
Referred by?
By GP, by the wellbeing clinic, by themselves. Some people just walk in.
There are various types of counselling. What type does the Counselling Foundation mainly cover?
There are different modalities of counselling. And the foundation, the work that they do for GPs is often short term and is perhaps a more generic type of counselling. So you may get a counsellor that's been taught in integratively, so they would have a toolbox of different counselling skills. The actual training that we offer, which is a 5-year training if you want to be a psychotherapist, we only train in a psychodynamic modality.
What does that mean, psychodynamic?
All counselling work is based on the ideas of Freud originally, but the psychodynamic approach is using the idea that your past is in your present. And the idea that you have an unconscious mind. Now, not every remodality would work like that. They might work in a much more here and now way. But the foundation that was started 45 years ago has always been linked to the psychodynamic modality. In a way, that was the world of counselling 45 years ago anyway. You know, most counsellors were trained in that kind of way. And I think the big issue about counselling is whether people want to work in a short-term way about their issues or whether they want to perhaps have longer to talk about what's happened to them. And the psychodynamic model is often open-ended so that people come and they're given time to tell their story in all its aspects. That's something we're good at, we believe in, we've got excellent tutors and have developed really good training. I mean, every year we get probably about 100 or so students that want to come on the foundation certificate course that I'm responsible for. And we teach them, half would be skills of listening, of, you know, using empathy, understanding. The other half is the theory that backs it up. So you would have some idea of human growth and development and how people move through their lives and what is important and what might have been difficult, really. It's a very non-judgmental approach, as all counselling is anyway. Being able to offer open-ended counselling allows people to go at their own pace.
presumably you have to resist the temptation to suggest what people could do. They have to come to their own conclusions about the way forward.
And of course, it's done in a way in which people feel safe. They know what they're signing up to. They know that a session is 50 minutes. They know that the counsellor isn't going to talk about themselves, that they're there for them, and that they can contain the anxieties and not going to be particularly shocked or worried about what people tell them. We have a huge range of ages of people. I think lots of people sign up to do counselling courses as a way of learning about themselves and perhaps their own problems. And the course itself is extremely challenging. And I do warn people that we talk about things that may trigger them, and they have to be quite resilient. It's not something to be taken on lightly.
After all these years involved in palliative care and in counselling as well, you must be very well equipped to deal with the challenges that your own life have thrown at you. Do you feel that?
My big challenge is how you manage being older and the loss associated with being old, not being able to run for the train, but also remembering that one of the great writers of psychodynamic theory, Bion, who once said, "It's never too late to be the person you were meant to be."
A good note to finish on.
It is a good note to finish on.
Pam Firth, thank you very much indeed for telling us all about your job and your career today.
And thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Well, my thanks to Pam Firth and to Jill Burridge for this, the latest in our series looking at local people and the work they do.